Macmillan Audio presents My Story by Elizabeth Smart with Chris Stewart, read by Elizabeth Smart. This book is dedicated to the safe return of missing children everywhere. I'd like to thank my parents, Ed and Lois Smart, my immediate and extended family, people who searched and prayed for me everywhere, Chris Stewart, and my wonderful husband, Matthew Gilmore. The power of choosing good and evil is within the reach of all of us. Origen Adamantius. For we are troubled on every side, yet not distressed. We are perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not forsaken, cast down, but not destroyed. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. Prologue. November 2001. We had just walked out of the ZCMI store downtown Salt Lake City. The heavily tinted windows with their grated iron accents were at our backs as we waited to cross the street. Traffic was light. I remember it was cold. The Mormon Temple and Visitor Center was just a block away, and high-rise buildings rose on every side. Salt Lake City was getting ready for the Winter Olympics, and there was construction all around. The sky was gray and clear, and the sun was moving quickly toward the western horizon. There weren't a lot of pedestrians. Winter was coming on. So the beggar was hard to ignore standing among the well-dressed crowd. He didn't seem to notice as we walked by. I was on my mother's right, my little sister on her left, holding my mother's hand. We had been shopping, and I carried a couple of little bags. I was a teenager, but just barely, with blonde hair and blue eyes. As we walked, I remember glancing at my mother. She was very pretty. I liked being with her. She was one of my best friends. Salt Lake City was not a dangerous place. And I had the luxury of growing up with a mother who was open and unassuming. Her demeanor was friendly, yet careful. Standing by the beggar, waiting to cross the street, I looked and made eye contact with him. My brothers had already seen him and had come back to ask my mom if we had any work for him. Mom glanced at him warily, not wanting to stare. I don't remember a lot about him, but I do recall that he was clean-cut and well-groomed. No beard, no robes, no singing or talking about prophets or visions or being the chosen one. All of that would come later. For now, he appeared to be nothing more than a normal guy who had hit a rough patch in his life. He certainly didn't seem to be dangerous or threatening. I thought he was a man down on his luck, my mom would later testify. He just lost his job, looked young enough that maybe he had a family, people he was responsible for. So she walked toward him, $5 in her hand. I held back, my hair blowing in the autumn wind. He glanced in my direction, seeming to take me in from the corner of his eye. I gave him a quick smile. I felt sorry for him and was happy when my mother handed him the money. What I didn't know, but would later learn, was that he had been watching me very carefully as we walked toward him. He had taken the opportunity to study me further as my mom searched through her purse. He remembered everything about me. The clothes that I was wearing, my blonde hair, the way I looked up at my mother, the color of my eyes. And though he was very careful not to show it, he decided at that moment that I was the one. Chapter 1. Elizabeth. It's funny. Some of the things that I remember, many of the details forever burned in my mind. It's as if I can still smell the air, hear the mountain leaves rustle above me, feel the fabric of the veil that Brian David Mitchell stretched across my face. I can picture every detail of my surroundings. The tent, the wash basin, the oppressive dugout full of spiders and mice. I can feel the cut of the steel cable wrapped so tightly around my ankle, the scorch of the summer heat lifting off the side of the hill, the swaying of the Greyhound bus as we fled to California, I can still see the people who were around me, their blank expressions, their fear of how we were dressed, my veil and the dirty robes, the looks of confusion in their eyes. I remember so many overwhelming feelings and emotions. Terror that is utterly indescribable, even to this day. Embarrassment and shame so deep, I felt as if my very worth had been tossed upon the ground. Despair, starving hunger, fatigue and thirst, and a nakedness that bears one to the bones. Intruding hands, pain and burning, the leering of his dark eyes, a deep longing for my family, a heartbreaking yearning to go home. All of these memories are a part of me now, the DNA inside me. Indeed, these are the things that have moved and shaped me, sometimes twisting, sometimes wrenching me into the person I am today. Sometime long before I was taken, I had been told that when someone dies, the first thing you forget is the sound of their voice. This thought terrified me. What if I could no longer remember my mother's voice, a sound I had heard every day of my life? I started to think of her and other members of my family and their voices. I started to think of all the things my mom used to tell me every day. Have a good day at school. I love you. Have a good night. I would have given anything to hear her at that moment. Every morning, she used to sing at the top of her lungs, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." I used to hate it. What would I have given to hear her voice again? Over the first few weeks of captivity, I forced myself to think of things like that. I remember sitting in the heat of the summer, the sun baking on my back, forcing myself to think of my mom's voice, her laugh, how beautiful she looked in her black skirt and gold top, the shape and the color of her eyes. But there were other feelings too, and though it might be hard to understand, a few of them were good, for they show you the things you cling to when everything is gone. I remember the pure rush of gratitude for any time that I could sleep, the realization that I would live another day, relief when the sun went down and the heat gave way to the cool of the night, gratefulness for food or water, a few minutes when I might be left alone, the ability to slip into a state of pure survival, a state of blankness, a quiet and painless place where I could shut the world down. Looking back, I realized that at one point early on the morning of the first day, something had changed inside me. After I'd been raped and brutalized, there was something new inside my soul. There was a burning now inside me, a fierce determination that no matter what I had to do, I was going to live. This determination was the only thing that gave me any hope, the realization that as long as I could survive one more day or one more hour, I might find a way to get back home. I also discovered something that is harder to imagine and much more difficult to explain. Sometime during the first couple of days, I realized that I wasn't alone. There were others there, beside me, unseen, but not unfelt. Sometimes I could picture them beside me, reaching for my hand. And that is one of the reasons I am still alive. When I think back on those dark nights of my capture, I realize my story didn't start on the night that Brian David Mitchell slipped into my bedroom and held a knife at my throat. In an odd way, my story began a few days before, Sunday afternoon, in my home. Just a few days before, my world was torn apart. Over time, I have gained an enormous appreciation for what I experienced on that Sunday. It has helped me to keep perspective, it helped to give me hope, and it helped me understand a little better why things might have happened the way they did. Chapter 2, Sunday School. 2 days before I was taken, I was sitting in my Sunday school class, surrounded by a group of other 14 and 15-year-olds. There were maybe 7 or 8 of us, a mix of boys and girls. Some of the kids were listening, but not everyone, for we were teenagers, you know. Looking around me, I was comfortable, for these kids were my friends. I had grown up with them, gone to school with them, eaten snacks at their houses, giggled with them on the playground. We knew one another well. Though there was some horseplay among the class, for the most part, I was quiet. I don't know if I was shy, but I guess I was. I just didn't feel a need to stand out. It surprises some people when I tell them that. Most of them picture me as an outgoing teenager, a cheerleader type, I think. But I wasn't. I was kind of quiet, a very obedient child, a 4.0 student. I played the harp, for heaven's sake. How a cheerleader is that? Some people say I'm pretty, blonde hair, blue eyes. But I promise, I've never thought of myself that way. As a 14-year-old girl sitting in my Sunday school class, I certainly didn't think of myself as beautiful. Honestly, I don't think I ever thought about it at all. Some of the girls I knew were boy crazy, but I never thought about those kinds of things. I didn't wear makeup. I had never had a boyfriend. The thought had never even crossed my mind. My favorite things were talking to my mom and jumping on the trampoline with my best friend, Elizabeth Calder. We just liked to have fun together. But our idea of fun wasn't chasing boys or prank calling other kids in our class. In almost every way, I was still a little girl. And one thing that I can say for certain is that I didn't understand the world. I remember pressing my white cotton dress, printed tulips with light green edging, with my hands while listening to the teacher. To most of us, he seemed to be 100 years old, with his gray beard and white hair. But we liked him. I felt he cared about us, even if we didn't listen to him all the time. That morning, my teacher said something that hit me in a way that few things ever had before. "If you will pray to do what God wants you to do, he will change your life," he said. I pressed my dress again, my head down. I was listening carefully to him now. I don't know what it was, but there was something in the way he said it, the intensity of his voice that made me realize that what he was saying was important. "If you will lose your life in the service of God, he will direct you. He will help you. So I challenge you to do that. Commit to Heavenly Father, and he will guide your way." But what can I do to serve God? I asked myself. I'm just a little girl. I don't know anything. I can't do anything. What path could he even guide me on? I didn't know the answers to these questions, but I felt that, whatever it might be, I had to do what my teacher had challenged me to do. Later on that day, I went to the bedroom I shared with my little sister, Mary Catherine, and shut the door. I went into the bathroom and locked it. On the other side of the bathroom was a walk-in closet. I went into the closet and shut that door, too. I have 3 younger brothers, a younger sister, and 1 brother who is 1.5 years older than me. With 6 kids, our house is always chaotic, full of life and voices. But there, in the closet, I was as alone as anyone could be in a home with 8 people. Kneeling down, I closed my eyes. I didn't know how to say it, but I did the best I could. "God, I'm here," I said. "I'm only 14. I know I'm just a little girl, but I'll do whatever it is you want me to do. I really do want to serve you, but I'm not sure that I know how." I waited a moment. Maybe I was waiting for something to happen, a vision, a revelation, some kind of sign from God. But nothing happened. So I got up and didn't think about it again. At least, not until 2 days later, when Brian David Mitchell took me from my house and forced me to start climbing up the mountain in the middle of the night. Struggling up the side of a hill, breathless and terrified, a bearded man behind me and a long knife to my back. With scratched arms and my silky red pajamas clinging to my legs, I couldn't help but wonder, "God, is this what you had in mind?" I was so confused and so afraid. "I don't understand. I did what you have asked me. This can't be what you wanted." And it certainly wasn't. I know that now. Being taken captive was not part of some great eternal plan. But the confusion was overwhelming. My mind tumbled in sheer terror. This doesn't make any sense. I've never done anything wrong. And though it would take a while, the answers to my confusion eventually settled in my mind. I don't think what happened to me was something that God intended. He surely would not have wished the anguish and torment that I was about to go through upon anyone, especially upon a child. But since that time, I have learned an important lesson. Yes, God can make some good come from evil, but even He, in all His majesty, won't make the evil go away. Men are free. He won't control them. There is wickedness in this world, which left me with this. When faced with pain and evil, we have to make a choice. We can choose to be taken by the evil, or we can try to embrace the good. Chapter 3. Brian David Mitchell. Brian David Mitchell began his journey to my bedroom many years before he actually found himself standing beside my bed in the middle of the night. Indeed, the evil that grew inside him was planted very early in his life. But before I go any further, I'd like to make it very clear that Brian David Mitchell's life isn't something that I want to understand. It's not something I have studied or spent even a moment trying to figure out. Knowing him and his background is like learning about the devil, but I wasn't given any choice. I had been thrust into his life. Because of the situation in which I found myself, the abduction and the 7-year trial, I have been forced to come to know him in ways that no one else could. I know about his teenage conviction for pedophilia after exposing himself to a child. I know about his 3 marriages, the 13 children and stepchildren, more charges of child abuse. I know about his various stages of activity in his church, just enough to help him get the vernacular and religious customs down. More charges of abuse from his stepchildren, threats of violence against his family, an urgent marriage to Wanda Barzee on the very same day that the divorce from his second wife had been finalized. Barzee giving up all parental rights to her 6 children in order that they could marry. The growing realization that religion could be used to get what he wanted, whether from Barzee or someone else. The transition from a relatively quiet man to a controlling and abusive husband. Twisted relationships with other women, including invitations for them to become polygamous wives. An intense and sudden interest in Satan. Barzee feeling rejected because of his constant invitations to other women. A sudden surge of religious revelations that told him that he was chosen. Barzee accepting his lustful eye. The emergence of the Davidic king, separation from, and then the eventual severing of his relationship with, other members of his family. His own mother having a restraining order placed against him. Drugs and alcohol and pornography. The prophet Emmanuel taking to the city streets. No more jobs, no more money. He and Barzee hitchhiking across the country with nothing but what they had in their backpacks. The writing of the book of Emmanuel David Isaiah, a compilation of Mitchell's spiritual revelations, the decision to take me and make me his second wife. These are the defining moments of Brian David Mitchell's life. For me to have to wander through this web of darkness is very difficult, and to crawl inside his head can be terrifying, for it is a closed and evil place. But again, I had to understand him. I wasn't given any choice. It's also important to realize that understanding Brian David Mitchell is made very difficult by the fact that he is a master manipulator. To this day, he will rant and rave in gibberish, then suddenly pull into himself, holding his cards very close to the chest. It's as if he's always evaluating his next move, weighing the odds, trying to figure out the best way to control the situation. Even when he isn't ranting, meaningful conversation is utterly impossible, unless you are a prison guard or someone else who can give him something that he wants. He is selfish and angry, but he's also very smart, far more intelligent than most people want to give him credit for. That is important to remember. This is not a foolish man. Some say he is brilliant. Indeed, this proved to be part of his power, the ability to appear harmless and unassuming, even while he was plotting and demeaning and raging inside. Throughout the ensuing investigation, his family has cast very little light upon my capture, perhaps partly because they don't want to talk, and perhaps mostly because they simply don't understand him. He's had very few friends, and those few people he was ever close to were forced to abandon him as they realized what a wicked man he was. But though he has always refused to talk to authorities, and his background is depressingly convoluted, Brian David Mitchell has not hidden everything beneath his deceptions and his lies. Indeed, the trial of Brian David Mitchell for my kidnapping and criminal sexual assault left few stones unturned. Though I would happily have withdrawn myself from the process, I couldn't, for I was the central figure in the case, the most important witness, the reason for it all. Everything that was said or done during the trial had to be focused to some extent on me. But I also understand that thousands of hours have gone into building the prosecutor's case, dozens of investigators, police officers, attorneys, doctors, judges, psychiatrists, mental health officers, criminal forensic specialists, jurists, and advocates helped to pull the various pieces together, each of them having a bit of the story to tell. Press reports provide thousands of pages of additional information. Indeed, and I say this with very mixed emotions, few stories have so captured the nation's attention as did my case, the abduction and trial being covered extensively among the local, national, and international press. But while these sources may be helpful in understanding Brian David Mitchell, the real story can only be told by those of us who were there. Mitchell's wife, Wanda Barzee, is one of those, and she wasn't an innocent bystander. She is a wounded and evil woman, a mother who once secretly fed her daughter her own pet rabbit, watching her eat it with a smile, who must accept her share of the blame. But at least she has been somewhat willing to discuss the events that took place. Of course, there's also Brian David Mitchell. But once he was finally captured, he went from incessant talking to not speaking at all, which leaves the keys to the story lying in my hands. I am the one who lived through 9 months of hell. I am the one who was forced to lie beside Mitchell every night. I am the one who had to listen to his stories, including long and wandering tells that revealed some of the most intimate details of his life. I am the one who felt his hot breath on my face, hiked with him atop the mountain, washed with him, ate and napped with him, hid behind dumpsters and in the mountains with him, hitchhiked and rode on a cross-country bus with him. I am the one who was forced to watch things between Barzee and him that no one should ever be forced to see. I am the one who witnessed Mitchell turn away Barzee's jealous rage with nothing but a soft word about his weakness and a blessing upon her head. I am the one who had to listen to his incessant talking, sometimes interrupted only long enough that he could rape me, before going back to sharing his insights once again. I am the one who saw him play other people like a fiddle, watched him deal with police and investigators, people who were trained to spot deception, as if they were nothing but children in a game of hide-and-seek. I saw his calm, I saw his cool, I saw him constantly pull the wool over other people's eyes. I saw all this and more, which is why I know Brian David Mitchell better than any other person in the world. Believing I would be his wife forever, he told me about it all. I know his comings and goings in the months leading up to the night when he snuck into my room. I know what he did on the day he came to take me. I know how he planned it, where he walked, and what he ultimately had in mind. I know that he decided to take me after seeing me on that November afternoon when I had been shopping with my mother in downtown Salt Lake City. I know that he had plotted from the beginning, offering to rake leaves and repair my father's roof in order to find out where I lived. I know he manipulated his way into my home in order to note the location of my bedroom and my sleeping arrangements. I know what he did to prepare for the kidnapping, staking out the mountains high above the city in the months and weeks before that fateful night in June. I know that he bought the hardware he would need, steel cable, bolts, a couple of padlocks, and orange-handled bolt cutters. I know he moved his and Barzee's summer camp, trudging higher up the mountain where it would be more difficult to be found. There at the upper camp, as they called it, he expended enormous effort to excavate a dugout among the trees, cutting thick logs to make a roof and leveling the hill in order to provide a shelter where he intended to spend the winter with Barzee and his new wife. I know he didn't spend all his time living like a hermit on the mountain. He told me how he frequently walked the streets of Salt Lake City, bumming for alcohol, looking for a party, stealing from the local market, begging for food. I know that he was lazy, feeling too entitled to really work, preferring to hang out on the streets. He liked to call it ministering, but his life was bumming and nothing more. I also know that, as time went by, he slipped deeper and deeper into his caricature of a prophet. But none of it was real. Brian David Mitchell is not insane. The professional analysis is clear. He is a manipulative, antisocial, a narcissistic pedophile. He is not clinically psychotic or delusional. He is just an evil man. Brian David Mitchell slipped too easily in and out of prophecy for it to ever be his actual state of mind. He simply used the culture and language of religion to manipulate people in order to get what he wanted. I witnessed it again and again. When he really needed something, knowing that prophets were difficult to take seriously, he could turn the switch off and act very rational. When the situation required it, he could act very sane. Still, as the night of the kidnapping grew near, he decided that the persona of a modern-day prophet was the way to go. Way less work, way more opportunities for mischief and manipulation, and the ability to claim that he was a man who spoke to God was pretty exciting. It carried a little punch, a bit of power. It got him attention and helped to explain some of his unconventional behavior. So he lost the Levi's and started walking around in robes and leather sandals. But even then, his intentions were only to manipulate. For example, when running around the mountain in sandals and dirty sheets proved to be impractical, he started stashing his sandals in a hollow oak he called the Shoe Tree. When he went down into the city, knowing that other people were going to see him, he'd bring out the sandals. Hiking back up to the mountain, knowing that no one else would be around, he'd stop at the Shoe Tree and put his hiking boots back on. As I have already testified in court, he was his number one priority, followed by sex, drugs, and alcohol. But he used religion in all of those aspects to justify everything. 9 months of living with him and seeing him proclaim that he was God's servant and called to do God's work and everything he did to me and my family is something that I know that God would not tell somebody to do. God would never tell someone to kidnap her at knife point from their bed, from her sister's side, never continue to rape her and sexually abuse her. Nor would God tell him to kill me. But that's what he was prepared to do. Chapter 4, Dark Night. June 4, 2002, the mountains east of Salt Lake City, Utah. Having walked the trail many times now, I know that Brian David Mitchell must have moved very quickly down the mountain, which is surprising, given the fact that it was a very dark night. I remember even now how the heavy trees that lined the narrow path sucked up most of the moonlight. The mountains are full of coyotes. I heard them almost every night once we were in the upper camp, and it is likely that some of them watched him from the ridge as he made his way toward the city. The maples and oaks along the trail are very thick, with occasional outcroppings of granite that drop into narrow depressions where the winter snows melt off. But it was early summer when he came to get me, and the ground was dry and packed. A gentle stream, hardly more than a trickle, ran through the bottom of the canyon, and he would have been forced to move among the peppermint and watercress in order to follow its path. As he moved down the mountain, no man saw him pass. Behind him, high up on the mountain, the other one was waiting to receive me with a dirty bed and clean linen robes. Coming down the mountain is pretty easy and can be done in as little as an hour. You follow a narrow canyon that drops sharply from the east to join a well-established trail that runs for about a half a mile toward the city. But although you can come down from the mountain fairly quickly, going back is much more difficult, and the going is always slow. The mountain is very steep, and the way is not well marked. So Brian David Mitchell was in a hurry, for he knew that on that night it would take us many hours. For one thing, it would still be dark, and he would have to guide me, knowing I would be looking to escape. He knew that he could make me hold the flashlight, allowing him to keep the knife at my back, but it would be awkward to move together, keeping his hands gripped tightly around my arm. Worse, he knew we could not go back up the same trail that he had used to come down. We'd have to go on the backside of the mountain. There, the mountain was very steep, and without a trail to follow, the brush and trees would be so thick we'd end up crawling on our hands and knees. Yet it was absolutely essential that we make it back to camp before the sun was up, before the darkness gave way to the summer light. He would have to have taken me up to where I could be hidden and no one could hear me if I screamed. A little after 1 a.m., Mitchell neared the bottom of the mountain. There the trail widened, allowing him to move more quickly. Everything he wore was black. Black sweats, black gloves, black stocking cap and beard. All of this allowed him to blend into the darkness like the shadow of a ghost. He balanced two military green sacks across his back. I remember them very clearly. They were tied together with a strand of material and bounced uncomfortably as he moved. As he came off the Wasatch Mountains, the lights of Salt Lake City would have slipped into view. From my house, the valley spreads south and west, neat rows of street lights that line up in almost a perfect grid. Brigham Young was nothing if not a visionary, and the city is designed along streets that run in neat north-south and east-west rows. To the north, an edge of the mountain to the west hides the northern portion of the valley. As he hiked down, Mitchell surely had to stop to take a break. He was not a young man, and though he seemed to be a fanatic about exercise, he suffered from poor nutrition and inferior hygiene. He and Barzee had skipped many meals, leaving him a little thin, and the alcohol and drugs he had pounded into his body would not have helped him catch his breath. But as tiring as it was to come down from the mountain, it would be much worse climbing back up. It seemed we would stop every few minutes so he could urinate and rest. Breaking from the stream bed, he would have been able to quicken his pace. Here, the lights of the city would have helped illuminate his path, and the moon wouldn't have been so obscured by the thick trees. Just before 2 a.m., he stood on the empty streets above the city. He was almost to my house. I lived on the east bench of the city, almost as high as any of the houses were allowed to be built. My neighborhood, beautiful homes, some new, some older, looked down on the University of Utah, the Capitol and downtown buildings, and the Mormon temple and towering skyscrapers situated around the city center. In the darkness, it must have taken him a moment to get his bearings, but he had studied the scene many times before. And even in the darkness, he knew exactly where to go. Breaking from the foothills, the terrain is bare, with only June grass, rock, and weeds. The first of the houses lie just below the trail. A ribbon of asphalt winds down toward the city. Streetlights line the road. But at 2 o'clock in the morning, there would have been few, if any, cars. Mine was a quiet neighborhood, a quiet city even. No one saw him as he hunched beside the road. He crossed Tomahawk Drive, then dipped through an empty lot to avoid another house before turning north again, bringing himself to look down on my backyard. It backed up to a steep part of the hill and was heavy with bushes and trees. A small storage shed was positioned along the hillside, nestled among the brush. He hid his bags in the weeds, then crept down a narrow path of flat stones to step onto the grass of my backyard. My house was dark inside. He first circled around, looking for a point of access. Finally, after making sure no doors had been left unlocked, he moved across the patio, past a row of empty windows toward the patio door. Stopping at a narrow window on the left side of the patio, he took out a knife. Long, deadly, a serrated blade. He carefully cut the screen and pushed against the glass. Earlier in the evening, my mother had burned something on the stove and my dad had left the window open, just a crack to air things out. The window pushed back on its hinges. He was able to get into the house. Mitchell later told me that for a moment he had hesitated. "If God wants me to do this, he will allow it," he said to himself. Mitchell knew that once he climbed through the window, he would be treading on very dangerous ground. From where he was on the patio, he was looking at trespassing, criminal mischief, attempted burglary, if the prosecutors really got on a roll. He would have claimed, of course, that he had been nothing but a hungry beggar, desperate to find a little food. If he'd been caught outside on our patio, he'd spend a few days in jail and nothing more. But once he crawled through the open window, everything would change. If he was caught inside the house, especially with a knife, that would be impossible for the prosecutors to ignore. And once he made his way toward my bedroom, that would be a completely different deal. Yes, he understood the repercussions, but he did not turn away. The window was too high, so he leaned an iron patio chair against the wall. Standing on the chair, he shimmied through and dropped onto the kitchen floor. The house was quiet. No barking dog, no sounding alarm. Again, he was surprised. "If God wants this," rolled around inside his head. Somewhere in the house a clock ticked, maybe in the kitchen, maybe somewhere down the hall. He moved through the kitchen and into the hallway. The front door was on his right, a wide stair on his left. He turned. The stairway rose before him. He moved up the stairs and headed down the hall. Which bedroom was I in? In the darkness, he couldn't tell. He reached out for the nearest door and slowly pushed it open. Soft light fell upon the bed along the wall. My little brother was sleeping there. He quietly shut the door, then moved a couple steps farther down the hallway until he stopped outside my bedroom door. Chapter 5. Taken. I woke up with my little sister sleeping beside me, a dark man standing over me, and a knife to my throat. Rough hands were pressed upon my body as the stranger leaned over, his dirty beard against my face. "I have a knife to your neck," he whispered. His voice was soft but very serious. "Don't make a sound. Get out of bed, or I'll kill you and your family." For a fraction of a moment, I was not fully awake. Caught in that fuzzy place between wakefulness and sleep where your body may be reacting, but your mind has not realized what is happening yet. Was I dreaming? Was this real? My mind was like molasses, slow, caught in uncertainty and fear. Then I felt the pressure of the knife, cold and sharp against my throat. "I have a knife to your neck," he repeated. "Don't make a sound. Get out of bed, or I'll kill you and your family." I was jolted awake. I felt the sharpness of the knife as he pressed it against my skin. My heart began to race, exploding in my ears. I fought the urge to scream, glancing at my little sister in the dark. The words he had spoken seemed to echo in my ear. "I will kill you and your family." I wanted to reach out for my little sister, to hold her, to protect her from this horrible thing. I needed to protect her. I froze in fear. Seeing the shadow of evil on his face, hearing the determination in his voice, and feeling the strength of his hands, I knew that he would kill us if he had to. From that moment forward, I never doubted what he would do. Let me be clear about that. I spent more than 9 months under his control. Every day that I spent with him made me more and more convinced that this man was capable of killing. He would have stuck me in an instant. There is no doubt, and never was. I quietly slipped out of bed. The man grabbed me by the arm. There was enough light that I could see his knife. It wasn't a pocket knife. This was much more than that. It was long and black and serrated. Maybe 8 inches long. It looked like it could cut right through me, right through my heart and bone. I can't describe the terror. It is simply impossible to express. Here I was, a little girl in the middle of the night, being taken from my bed, from my home, from what I thought was the safest place in the entire world. It was an unimaginable intrusion. Everything that I had thought, every feeling of safety or comfort, every assumption of protection was stolen in that instant. My world spun on its head. My mind began to race. Had he already killed my parents? Were other members of my family dead? What about my little sister, sleeping beside me in bed? Would he harm her? Would he kill her? What could I do to keep her safe? His hands were large and powerful as they pulled me from my bed. Holding the knife at my back, he pushed me toward my closet. All of the lights were turned off. On the way, I stubbed my toe. "Oh," I whispered, and he threatened me again. We passed through the bathroom, holding me very close, the knife always at my back. He pushed me inside the closet. One of us turned the light on, but I don't remember if it was me or him. "Get your shoes," he whispered in my ear. I bent toward a pair of slippers. "No," he spat, pushing me toward my white running shoes. "Get those." My heart sank in utter horror. Was he taking me outside? Sensing my hesitation, he leaned toward me again. "I'm taking you hostage for ransom." I felt myself deflate. It seemed the very life was ready to leave my body. My throat tightened up with fear. The light was on now, and I could see his face, his long beard, his dark brown hair. Everything he wore was dark. The terrifying knife. In every possible way, this was a very dark man. "Grab your shoes," he barked again. His voice was low but deadly. He was holding tightly to my arm, his fingers digging into me. I hardly noticed the pain. My body was flushing with adrenaline. I was trembling with fear. I picked up my white running shoes, the same ones that I had worn when I had gone jogging the night before. Bending over, I started to put them on. "No, not now. Bring them with you," he ordered. He pushed me toward the bedroom door. We slowly moved out into the hall. He stayed right behind me, never more than a fraction of an inch away. The long knife was always close. "Not a sound," he told me. "I'll kill you and your entire family." My heart pounded in my chest. I felt the itch of his beard against my neck. He led me toward the stairs. It was dark and quiet. None of my family was awake. Deadly quiet. Deadly darkness. I could hear the grandfather clock ticking from downstairs. He led me down the hall and pushed me past the stairs. Realizing his mistake, he forced me to backtrack, then led me down to the main hall. "Dad, please wake up," I was praying in my mind. "Mom, can you hear me? Please wake up and save me." "What is the quickest way out?" he whispered as we stood in the main entry. I hesitated, feeling sick with utter fear. "He's going to take me outside," I thought. "He's going to hurt or kill me." I felt the knife against my back, cold, hard. I imagined the cut of the blade into my body. "The sliding glass door is behind us," I answered, afraid that I was going to cry. He acted like he didn't hear me. Pushing me forward, he directed me through the kitchen, past the pantry, toward the back door. Out we went. We were on the patio now. He was always very close, controlling everything I did. He directed me across the backyard and up the hill to the side yard near the top of our property. I felt his arms tighten up around me as he pulled me to a stop. "Put on your shoes now," he said. "Why are you doing this?" I cried. He looked at me in anger. "I'm taking you hostage." I knelt down and pulled my shoes on. I wasn't wearing any socks. I glanced back toward my house. It was still completely dark. I felt a yearning to rush back there. Then I felt the knife again. He pushed me up the hill. We were walking through the empty lot. Scrub oaks, lots of dry brush and grass. He suddenly stopped me, reaching down among the weeds, picking up the two green bags that had been tied together with a rag. He slung them over his back and chest. The road behind my house runs up against the mountain. Reaching the top of the empty lot, we hit the road. He pushed me to the left. The road sloped gently downhill. A hedge ran along the front of the nearest house. Headlights illuminated the side of the mountain as a car came winding down the road. Immediately, he thrust me behind the bushes, pressing me toward the ground. The grass was damp. The night was cold now. As he held me close, I realized how powerful he was. Peering through the hedge, crouched just a few inches off the ground, I watched the car approaching. I saw the lights on top of the roof, then the markings on the door. A police car! It was a miracle! It was going to be okay! "If this is the work of God, then let this police car pass without finding us," the dark man said as he held me to the ground. The car drew nearer, its headlights illuminating the winding road. "If you move, I'll kill you. If you make a sound, I'll kill you." He held the knife against my chest. I watched the car pass in front of us, no more than 10 feet away. The stranger seemed to hold his breath. I felt the tension in his body. The car was moving slowly. I didn't know what to do. He seemed to sense what I was thinking and held me tighter. "Move, and I will kill you," he said again. The police car passed. The man waited only a second before he pulled me up again, directing me across the road. On the other side was a trailhead that led up the side of the mountain. We started climbing up the trail. The reality finally hit me. It was like a jolt to my heart, a stabbing pain in my chest. This isn't a joke. This isn't a nightmare. This is real. I've got to run. But he was always right behind me, the knife always at my back. He held on to me with a tight grip that hurt my arm. The trail was steep around us, thick trees and rock on all sides. If there had ever been an opportunity, that time had passed. As we started climbing, I gathered courage. "Who are you?" I begged. "Why are you doing this? I have never done anything wrong." He continued pushing me up the mountain. "Why are you doing this?" I begged again. "I'll explain to you later, when we get to where we're going." We continued climbing. The night was dark. He forced me to hold a flashlight to illuminate our way. He held the knife in one hand, his arm always at my waist or shoulder. "Do you realize what you're doing?" I pleaded. "Of course," he seemed to huff. He had told me that he intended to hold me for ransom, but I didn't believe that anymore. "If you let me go, I won't press charges. I won't let my father press charges on you," I said with as much conviction as I could muster. He huffed again. The trail was getting steeper. "You don't need to make me any promises," he said in a sarcastic tone. "I know what I'm doing. I understand the consequences of my actions." He didn't sound crazy. He only sounded mean. Up and up we climbed. The trail grew narrow and more difficult. Farther up, there were trees on every side. We climbed and climbed. I was getting tired and very thirsty. He stopped to drink, pulling a canister of water out of one of his bags. He didn't offer me any. Not this time. Later he would, but I didn't want to drink from his water anyway. He urinated. Then we kept on climbing. A stream bed joined the trail on our right. "Turn up the stream bed," he commanded, though the trail continued. We left it and headed up the rocky stream bed. The going became even more difficult. Boulders, so many trees, so much thick brush. Yet he was always right behind me, matching my every move. I thought of the story of Moses and the parting of the Red Sea. I thought, okay, God, this isn't the Red Sea. This is just some scrub oak. Could you please just part it so I can run away? I kept looking for an opening, for any means to escape. But the man was right behind me. He had a knife on me, and if he wasn't right behind me, he was in front of me and always holding tight. So I kept climbing. It got colder. It was the middle of the night. I was praying and pleading for a way to escape, but there were steep slopes along the stream bed, walls of scrub oak on each side. It was hopeless, and I knew it. By then, I'd had enough time to consider another option that I hadn't thought about before, something just as terrifying, but not as likely to enter into the mind of a little girl. Please, I begged, if you're going to rape and kill me, please do it here. That way, someone will find my body. Keep moving, he replied. We kept on climbing. It was painfully slow, so dark, so steep, so many obstacles. Stop, he commanded. I stood there in the dark. I listened as he urinated once again. He mumbled to himself, we're going to wait here until daylight. He seemed to be thinking to himself, was he getting tired? Were we really just going to sit there on the rocks until the sun came up? I turned around to look at him. He was not very tall, with narrow shoulders and a slim chest. It was too dark to see much more than just the outline of his body, and his beard hid most of his face. But I could see his cheeks and his eyes. Then it hit me. I remembered him. I had seen him once. No, twice before. Once when I was shopping downtown with my mother, sometime in the fall, she had given him a little money. She had given him my dad's name and cell phone number so that they could help him more. My father had hired him to do some handiwork, just before Thanksgiving, I thought. I also remembered watching him from the upstairs railing that looks down on our front hall. He had looked up to see me watching him while he was waiting to get paid. Why are you doing this? I pleaded. My parents were only trying to help you. You are my hostage, he replied. You'll learn. I'll tell you what you need to know when we get to where we are going. My parents never hurt you. Why are you doing this? All will be made known in due time. Where are we going? He didn't answer. My parents will pay any amount of money to get me back, anything you ask for. Again, he didn't answer. Though he claimed I was his hostage, he showed no interest in talk of ransom or any money. He stood there in the darkness without responding in any way. The long knife in his hand, he gestured further up the mountain. My wife is waiting up there, he said. Might he only want a daughter? I wondered. The idea tumbled inside my head. I soon discovered that being taken to be his daughter was an enormously optimistic hope. He pointed up the mountain. It was steep, so rough. Looking at it, I realized we'd have to crawl in places. Dawn was getting closer now. The sky was still dark, but the eastern horizon was turning a hint of gray. Moving closer to me, he repeated, "If you try to run, I will catch you. Do exactly what I say, or I will kill you. I have friends. They will kill your family, your little sister, all the others, if you try to escape. If you do anything that I don't tell you, I will kill you and your family." I felt his breath upon me. Do you understand? I understood, and I believed him. He stared at me, then grunted, "Let's go." I turned and started crawling up the mountain once again. Chapter 6, Mary Catherine. My younger sister, Mary Catherine, remembers being wakened by a nudge, but she figured it was just me and drifted back to sleep. Seconds later, she was jolted, fully awake, when she realized that I was climbing out of bed. Opening her eyes, she saw a stranger standing there, taking her older sister, holding a long knife, to my chest. A large, uncovered window let some light into the room, shadows of darkness cast by the stars and the moon. Mary Catherine watched what was happening through half-opened eyes, pretending to be asleep, her heart racing in her chest. The man stayed very close to me, pushing me toward the bathroom. "What are you doing?" she heard me ask. The answer was too muffled to really understand. Hostage? Maybe hitchhike. She didn't know what he said, but she did pick up on kill and your family, and was even more terrified. She watched as I moved toward the bathroom, the stranger right beside me, the door shut. Light seeped into the bedroom from underneath the door. Very muffled voices. A few minutes passed. The light went out. The door opened. Quiet footsteps. A floorboard creaking. The sound of muffled movement in the hall. And then quiet. Deadly quiet. Mary Catherine was utterly petrified, frozen stiff with fear. And how could she not be? She was a 9-year-old girl who had just witnessed her older sister being taken from her bed by a stranger with a long beard and a knife, a man who had hissed and pulled and held her so close that she could not get away. It was just too much to manage. My 9-year-old sister lay underneath her covers, too terrified to even move. She hardly dared to breathe. She was in a deep state of shock, completely numb with fear. An agonizing amount of time passed. She didn't sleep. The grandfather clock chimed downstairs. Still, she didn't move. More time passed. How long? She didn't know. The shadows traced the movement of the moon across her bedroom wall. The clock chimed again. She poked her head out from the covers. Starlight and moonlight filtered into the room, yellow, dull. She reached across the blankets to the left side of the bed. The sheets were flat and cool. I was not there. Finally, in a moment of courage, she grabbed her baby blanket, pulled it over her head, and bolted toward my parents' room. It was a few minutes before 4 in the morning. I had been gone for hours. Some questioned how Mary Catherine could have delayed telling our parents that I had been taken. What could she have been thinking? It was the obvious thing to do. And yes, it might be obvious if you are an adult and have the benefit of understanding the situation. And yes, it might be obvious if, at this moment, you don't feel overwhelming fear. But Mary Catherine was a child who had just had the most traumatic experience of her life. She thought that her bedroom, inside her house, with her parents and brothers sleeping all around her, her older sister at her side, was the safest place in the world that she could be. She knew that her father always locked the doors and the windows before he went to bed. She knew they had a security system. Yet a stranger had overcome all of these safety measures and gotten into their house. Then he had found his way into their bedroom. How did he even know where they slept? Once inside their room, he had pulled her older sister from her bed. He had threatened to kill her, threatened to kill their entire family. He was holding a long and terrifying knife. Her older sister had gone without fighting. How could any of this be? Was someone with him? Were other killers inside the house? It didn't make any sense. The only thing she knew was that she feared for her life. And we have to keep in mind that she was just a little girl. Adults think differently. We are rational, and we now have the benefit of hindsight knowing what really happened on that night. We know that Brian David Mitchell had already taken me from the house, that he could no longer threaten my little sister. We know my parents had not been killed or injured, that they were sleeping in their bed. But these things, Mary Catherine didn't know. Lying underneath her covers, she had to wonder, was the bad man still in the house? Was he lurking in the hall? He had said that he would kill our entire family. Were they dead already? If she ran into our parents' bedroom, what horrible thing might she find there? Had he killed other members of our family? was she alone inside a house where everyone else was dead? It is impossible for us to appreciate the terrible fear she must have felt. We also should remember that she was hardly the first one to go into shock after having experienced an overwhelming crisis. It is common. There are even examples of men in combat who have frozen up in fear, unable to do the task that they were trained to do. Sometimes they shut down, losing their ability to function in almost every way, mentally, emotionally, physically, which is why their training is so important. Chaos leads to panic. Panic leads to fear. Fear can be debilitating to the point where the mind and body may shut down. During these times of gut-wrenching panic, a soldier's training and preparation is supposed to kick in to protect them. But Mary Catherine had not been prepared for such a life-and-death situation. She was just a little girl. Having gathered her wits about her, Mary Catherine finally raced into her parents' bedroom. Running to my father's side of the bed, she spoke but didn't manage to wake him, so she moved to my mother's side. "Elizabeth is gone," she said in a quiet voice, her baby blanket still draped over her head. My mother opened her eyes. Mary Catherine had said it so softly, so matter-of-factly, that my mother didn't know what to think. It wasn't unusual for me to move into another room to sleep. Sometimes I would sleep downstairs on the couch, or maybe on the floor in one of my brother's rooms. Surely they would find me there. Hearing their voices, my dad sat up on his side of the bed. "Elizabeth is gone," Mary Catherine said again. Mother sat up now, her face growing concerned. "You won't find her. A man came and took her." She hesitated. "He had a gun," she mistakenly concluded. Both of my parents were instantly terrified. Something in the simple way Mary Catherine had said it made them realize that something was very wrong, and neither of them could ignore the look of utter fear upon her face. My father raced to check the other upstairs bedrooms. Not finding me, he ran down the stairs to the main floor. My mother followed. Mary Catherine stayed right next to her, unwilling to leave her side. They searched frantically, my father running through the rooms in the front of the house, hoping to find me sleeping on the couch. My mother turned on the lights in our family room. Of course, I was not there. She fought a building panic. Turning to her right, she moved into the kitchen. Mary Catherine ran along beside her, never more than a step away. Mom turned on the kitchen lights and looked around. The smell of burned potatoes still lingered in the air, but there was something more now. Other smells. Damp grass, canyon winds, the smells of the outdoors. Her eyes went straight to the cut screen. Then she stopped, moving her hand to her mouth, looking at it. She felt her heart freeze like a brick of ice inside her chest. She knew instantly what it meant. She let out a scream, yelling, "Call 911! My dad came racing into the kitchen. My mom's face showed nothing but fear and utter disbelief. Dad stopped in the middle of the kitchen and followed her eyes. He saw the open window. He saw the knife cut in the screen. Mary Catherine's words seemed to hang in the air between them. "Elizabeth is gone. You won't find her. A man came and took her. He had a gun." Chapter 7, Morning Light. We climbed all night. It was a terrible struggle going up the backside of the mountain without the benefit of any trail. It was climbing and crawling and moving through rough patches of weeds and thick trees. As the sky changed from black to gray to pink to light blue, the man became more and more agitated, more in a hurry, more anxious to get out of sight. As the sun broke, we were just crossing the highest ridge on the mountain. The sky was clear, with not a single cloud. And I suppose that you could see for miles. I was wearing a pair of red silk pajamas that had been given by a friend of my mother's. The man looked at the bright clothing in the growing light. "Someone is going to see you," he said in anger. I looked down at my pajamas. They were very bright. He said something more about a runner seeing me, something I really didn't understand. What kind of runner would be up here on top of the mountains? Then he reached into his bag and pulled out a gray shirt. I don't remember if I put it on or not, but I do remember that he made me hurry. By this time, the man had put away his knife. He figured I couldn't get away from him now. Still, he always stood beside me, ready to grab me if I ever made a run for it. Over the top of the ridge we moved, dropping onto a steep canyon on the other side. There the trees were not as thick, seeming to grow in patches of scrub oak and small pines, with a few quakies scattered in, most of them nearer to the bottom of the canyon. There was thick grass and weeds, and the mountain dropped steeply toward the south. Above the tree line there was a large basin of barren terrain we had to cross. The man almost made me run, so worried was he that I might be seen. I was exhausted by then. I'd been climbing all night. I was terrified and thirsty and dreading whatever lay ahead, but I moved quickly with him, too terrified to resist. We hiked across a barren patch of grass, thistle, and weeds. Then he pulled me toward a grove of mountain oaks that was about a third of the way down the ridge. Approaching the trees, he stopped and called out, "Hepzibah!" A woman's voice answered from the trees, "Emmanuel!" He seemed relieved and moved faster toward the voice. The old woman was waiting for us near the trees. I studied her hopefully, but her hard stance and cold eyes told me she was anything but a friend. She had a wild look about her, emotional and tense, like a strand of wire that was being pulled too tight. She had straggly brown and gray hair, a broad face and brooding eyes. She looked older than she was, and it was obvious that she had lived a hard life. Her eyes were dull, but grew excited now, an ember of fire beneath her drooping lids. She had rough hands and a rough manner that was all business and curt. She was dressed in a linen robe, not the kind you tie at your waist, but those you have to slip over your head. It shocked me to see her dressed like that, up there on the mountain. That turned out to be one of the first clues as to what lay in store for me. The first thing she did was walk up and put her arms around me, pulling me into a strong embrace. But it was not a warm thing, not an act of kindness, and certainly not an act of love. No, it felt more like an act of dominance than any sort of welcome. "I am stronger than you are, and don't ever doubt it. When it comes to you and me, I am number one." I felt dangerously out of place, standing there in my red pajamas. Though my top had a collar, some time before, to be more modest, I had taken a safety pin and pinned it a little higher. I touched the collar, then thought of my mother, knowing she had a set of pajamas the same as mine. Thinking of her, I wanted to cry. I glanced quickly around the camp, trying to take it in. It was primitive, but well-stocked. Tents, tarps, other things. They had obviously been up there for a while. I don't really know what time it was, probably close to mid-morning. It had been something like 6 or 7 hours since I had been taken. I don't remember feeling tired any longer, but I remember feeling very scared. Emmanuel, I didn't know his real name yet, nodded, seeming to signal to the older woman. Hepzibah, again, I didn't know her name was Wanda Barzi, nodded back. Without any explanation, she took me by the hand and pulled me toward the large tent. It was obvious they had planned out what was going to happen before I'd been brought into camp. As she pulled me by my arm, I knew that my world was about to come apart. Chapter 8. Rape of a Child. Stopping outside the tent, I had a better chance to look around. It was a big tent. Maybe 6 people could sleep inside it. A large tarp had been placed on the dirt in front of it, with another tarp hung from the trees, making a roof of sorts that hung over the camp. There were several blue rubber-made plastic containers. Lots of kitchen utensils were out. It was a very well-stocked camp. On the far side of the tent, there was a large mound of dirt where part of the mountain had been shoveled away. More than 12 logs were piled on one another, thick and heavy. It would have taken a lot of power to move them into place. I didn't know yet what it was, some kind of dugout or winter bunker, but it was imposing, and depressing to look at it, and I had to turn away. Opening the flap, the woman pulled me into the tent, which was filled with bedding. She had a blue basin already set up, the kind that hospitals give to young mothers to wash their brand new babies in. She'd already filled it with clean water. She pushed me toward an upside-down bucket and told me to sit down on it. She took off my running shoes and placed my feet into the hot water and washed them. Then she told me to take off my red pajamas. I pulled back in horror. "No," I cried. She scowled, her dark eyes hard. I could see, even then, that I was not going to be able to tell her no. But she forced herself to be patient. I didn't know it yet, but this was to be my wedding day. It was supposed to be a beautiful occasion. So the woman forced herself to be patient, showing a little leniency, at least for now. "I need to bathe you," she said through a tight smile. I recoiled even further, pressing against the fabric of the tent. "I took a shower last night," I whispered, somehow thinking I could convince her to leave me alone. She hesitated, then yelled toward the zipper flap. "She says that she had a shower last night. Is that okay?" Both of us looked toward the tent door, my stomach crawling into my chest. There was a moment's hesitation as he considered. The absurdity was surreal. It was as if she were asking, "Is she clean enough for you?" "Yeah, that's okay," he answered. His voice was very close. He was waiting just outside the tent, anxious, a starving animal ready to devour. She turned to me again, my feet still inside the basin. "Take your clothes off," she repeated. "No," I said again. "Take them off or I'll have him come in and rip them off you," she rasped in anger. I knew that she would call him in, and I knew he would indeed come and do exactly as she said he would do. Pulling away, I started crying. I couldn't stop. My heart seemed to break inside me. The tears left my face wet, my eyes stinging and red. "Take your clothes off, or he will rip them off you," she repeated. She then handed me a white robe. Again, it wasn't the kind you can wrap around your body, but one you have to pull over your head. I quietly slipped it on and wiggled out of my pajamas underneath. She waited and then pointed, "Take off your underwear." I choked on more tears. "No," I stumbled simply. "I'll have him rip them off your body." Her voice was firm and certainly not kind. Lowering my eyes, I slipped them off. She looked at me with satisfaction, then crawled toward the opening of the tent. I sat on the bucket, sick with dread, huge tears rolling down my cheeks. My body was so tight, I felt I couldn't breathe. I shivered, my feet still wet. I waited, crying softly as he came into the tent. He had changed his clothes and was now dressed in a linen robe just like mine, except his had a sash tied around the waist. I waited on the bucket, my head low. Tears of horror filled my eyes. I choked in order to keep on breathing. He started talking, but through my sobbing it was difficult to understand what he was saying. Then I caught some of his words. "I seal you to me on this earth, and what is sealed here on earth will be sealed in the afterlife, and I take you to be my wife, before God and his angels as my witnesses." "No!" I screamed, unable to contain my horror. He reached out as if he were going to slap me, moving suddenly very close. "If you ever scream again, I'll duct tape your mouth shut," he sneered. Then he forced me off the bucket and onto the dirty bedding. I fought him as best I could. "I'm just a little girl," I begged in desperation. "I haven't even started my period. I'm still a child." He stopped, his face tight, as if he were suddenly unsure of what to do. He yelled outside to the woman, telling her what I had said. "Is it still okay?" he asked. My heart leaped in hope. I was a child. Might there be a miracle? Might he let me be? The woman didn't hesitate. "It's okay," she answered. He turned to me again. I fought and kicked and struggled. I did everything I could, but he was a powerful and driven man. There was nothing I could do. When it was over, he got up and crawled out of the tent, leaving me crying on the floor. Over the next 9 months, Brian David Mitchell would rape me every day, sometimes multiple times a day. He would torture and brutalize me in ways that are impossible to describe, would starve and manipulate me like I was an animal. Many times I would think, okay, this is the bottom. Things couldn't get any worse. But whenever I began to think that way, I would quickly find out that I was wrong.